McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11 a.m, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
Dan Hendrickson is back, and he's an award-winning author of Railroad Man, Legacy Son. It's a powerful Western that weaves together courage, love, conflict, and legacy during one of the most defining moments in frontier history. And by the end of this episode, you're going to understand why storytelling shapes identity more than we realize, why modern life feels disconnected from meaning and legacy, what we can learn from the grit, courage, and moral tension of the Old West, and how powerful stories can actually help you reconnect with your own purpose. Dan, it's so good to see you again.
It's great to see you, Lisa. Great to be here.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk about your book. The last episode, we were talking about the last book, and this one is a continuation of that, from my understanding. Can you share with us what led you back to storytelling and why writing this story felt important to you in this moment?
Well, the Railroad Man, Legacy Son is... part of an overall theme that I have throughout most of my books when I'm following a bloodline, the Edwards family. And the matriarch of that family is Brandy. Brandy is the one that I started at. And she's the first book that I wrote about Brandy was Brandy, Ballad of a Pirate Princess. And now it's back in like 2020, 2021. And that just became hugely popular. Everybody loved it. It was a great love story. It was a great action adventure pirate, you know, like Pirates of the Caribbean and other things that you see. Just a lot of great seafaring stuff going on there. Then it was so popular that people, you know, kept begging me for a sequel. And the next one I wrote was called Brandy, Dame of the Caribbean, where she was about 10 years older. She had two children, and her husband and her were still fighting for the abolitionist movement in the Caribbean. And she has to take on a pirate from the South China Sea who comes after her and her children. And she, you know, she obviously defeats him. But, you know, family and life goes on. And Brandy had two children. She had a little boy and a little girl. The little boy's name Arthur. And the little girl's name was Katrina, and they grew up. And Arthur was so inundated with all the ways that he was raised, being an abolitionist part with his parents, you know, going in and getting runaway slaves onto their ships and taking them to the Caribbean and dropping them off at maroons and places where they could live free. He decided when the Civil War broke out in the United States that he was going to run away and join the Navy in the United States so he could fight for the freedom of the slaves. So, and that actually was in Brandy, Dame of the Caribbean in the epilogue. So what I did is I took his story all the way through in this book, which is Railroad Man, Legacy Son. And this is like 22 years after the Civil War. He's, you know, in his middle 30s, and he is a railroad executive, and he has all that background that Brandy and his father, you know, gave him, and plus the training with the Shaolin priest that trained Brandy how to use the master swords and all that stuff that was in the old book. He had all that martial arts training, and he was, you know, he was every bit his parents' child, and he's, but he's, he had a very harsh thing happened to him during the Civil War where he had to witness the death of some slave children, and it really affected him badly. And so he walked away from military life. He walked away from any kind of fighting stuff, and he went into the becoming a railroad executive. Well, in the book, I show how he has to come full circle back to confront all the demons of his past. And he does it by falling in love with a woman who's the granddaughter of a chief in of the Crow Nation up in Wyoming, who he has to get permission to build his railroad through. And so that was a big deal back then, because, you know, the Continental Railroad went across the United States east to west. And so now the railroads were going north to south, all up and down the country, and they wanted to, connect the rest of the country so that they could ship things. Mainly, the biggest business back then was the beef industry, and there was a lot of money and a lot of wealth involved there. Well, the Cattlemen's Association did not want, and I mean all the cattlemen's associations back then, did not want the Indian tribes to build up their herds to the point that they could start competing against them at the beef market. Now there was a, you know, there's I don't know much about the politics of the reservations and stuff, but each state that set up a reservation, most of them set up a program where they would give Indian tribes certain amounts of beef, herds to feed their people, because what they did is we took these tribes that had this vast land that they could hunt on and support their people, and we condense it into a smaller pocket of land on these reservations, and it really, it hurt them as far as being able to take care of their people. So one of the things that they developed was giving them beef. Well, the Cattlemen's Association really didn't have any problem with that. What they had a problem with is those guys building up the herds and then having enough to sell. And that's what the railroad would allow them to do, because they didn't have to drive their cattle across thousands of miles. So they weren't allowed to leave the reservations. They could put the cattle on the trains, and the trains could take it to the to you know Chicago was the biggest one, the Chicago slaughterhouses. And so they all got scared that they were going to cut them out. You know, that they were gonna push them out, because the railroad was offering free shipping if you let them build the railroad line through their reservation. And so there was a lot of sabotage, a lot of subterfuge, a lot of industrial sabotage going on. Everybody wanted the railroad line to go through, but everybody wanted it their own way. So this guy Arthur, I put him right in the middle of that, and he shows up in Cheyenne, Wyoming in 1883, ready to take over the expansion of the railroad. He meets a girl who's working for the railroad. Her name is Island, and she is the granddaughter of the chief of the Crow tribe. Her father is a white man. He's a sheriff up in Sheridan, Wyoming. And so she went to the women's college down in Cheyenne to study secretarial skills and stuff, and she got a job at the railroad by the time he met her. Now, one thing leads to another, and they fall in love, and she helps him get through his depression over what he saw happen during the Civil War. But then, because she's the daughter of the chief, these cattlemen decide they're going to kidnap her and her mother, who's also related to the chief, his daughter and her granddaughter. And so Arthur's forced to go rescue them, but he's also walking a thin line because he's got to keep all parties happy, including his boss. And so there's a marshal that I have in there, William Lloyd. Now, William Lloyd, I brought him into the picture in Brandy, Dame of the Caribbean. William Lloyd was actually a real character during the Civil War. He was a Pinkerton spy that traveled up and down the Mississippi on Mississippi boats and spied on the South for the North. I put him in Brandy, Dame of the Caribbean, and now I have him in this book as a U.S. Marshal. And he also comes back and he reunites with Arthur, because they had gone on a mission together during the Civil War, the critical one where Arthur got all that dilemma happened to him. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, but the big impact of the story in my book is I think I found another little niche in history that isn't paid attention to that much, and that's the whole controversy that happened between the Indian tribes on the reservations and the cattlemen associations and the railroad. And it was a big, huge deal back then. I know in my hometown people still talk about it, and the Crow Nation up in up by Sheridan, Wyoming, was the Indian nation that stood with the U.S. military against Sitting Bull and those guys that slaughtered Custer. So they weren't very popular with the rest of the Indian tribes. And so I showed in the book where the other Indian tribes kind of united against Pretty Eagle when they kidnapped his daughter and his granddaughter. And so that's part of the mix. So it's just a lot of cool stuff in there. And I show Arthur as a very capable man, but he also has a couple of weaknesses. One of them is that, he's a borderline alcoholic because of what happened to him during the Civil War. My father had a lot of trauma from World War II, and I got to see what I took a lot of that trauma that we experienced in my family from him and put it into Arthur's character. Also how he was able to heal from him too. But there's a whole lot of things going on there. But the biggest
Wow.
thing is, like I said, is the Indian tribes, the railroads, and the Cattlemen's Association, and just how he has to walk that fine line and has to figure out how to make it all come together.
I love the complexity of this book and how all of these, the history just weaves everything together. What about the Old West, still resonates deeply with people today, do you think?
Oh yeah, very much so. It was an expansion time. It was a time where, people were basically not as well governed as they are today. There wasn't that much law out there. The sheriffs had a lot of responsibility on them. They relied a lot on the cavalry, the military, to protect them. And there were like women's rights. Wyoming was the first state in the United States to give women the right to vote. That happened back in 9 or 1860, I think 62, if I remember correctly. So they gave, and they weren't even a state yet, but they gave women the right to vote. Number one, because there wasn't very many women in the state, so they were trying to attract women to come. That was one of the big reasons. Another reasons was that a lot of the women that were part of that group that were activists for that set up headquarters right there in Wyoming in certain towns like Cheyenne and Casper. And so they also advocated for it. So I utilized that in the writing of the book, especially with Eileen's character, how she had kind of went against the grain and she wanted to, get involved with business, and she wanted to be a businesswoman, and she went down and she got secretarial training, which was the best was available to her at that time. But she's a little ramrod herself, and so her relationship with Arthur was enhanced because of that, not dehanced, because his mother was Brandy, so he was kind of used to that kind of one. So that was a great addition to that. And so the old West with the gunsling and all that, it's all in there. Different pistols and different types of firearm were showed. Also, I like to say that I did a lot of research on railroad engines and the different kind of railroad equipment that was used back then. And there's a point in the book where I used the most advanced engine developed for mountain travel called the Big Boy back then, and that has a big impact. Another big part of the story is a horse named Swiftwind, and he's a Appaloosa stallion. The tribes up in northern Wyoming and in Montana really love Appaloosas. They're a beautiful horse, and they kind of have like a mythical feeling for them up there. They really love that horse. And so this stallion was the he belonged to Chief Pretty Eagle's daughter, a pony, who is Island's mother. And this horse would not let anybody but Island or her mother, a pony, ride him. And he was a pretty he was a big, 16 hand high horse, which is really tall and big muscular horse. And the only people he'd ever let get on him are those two girls, until they got in trouble. And then I have him go find Arthur, and he lets Arthur ride him, which really freaks out the Indian tribes and everybody else that knows the horse, but he lets
Wow.
Arthur ride, and Arthur rides a Swiftwind in to rescue the mother and daughter. So that's pretty cool. And I think people like that a lot too.
Amazing. I love it. There's so much, like I said, there's so much to this book. So in Railroad Man, there's tension between the cultures, ambition, love, and power. Why was that important to show that complexity instead of a simple good versus evil type story?
And that's a great question, because there is no cookie cutter answer for what was going on back then. There were a lot of different factions pulling for their own what they wanted, and the tribes were not treated very well in a lot of ways. The military conquests and all that of the expansion westward, they're put on these reservations, and it took certain elements of the government to start, speaking up for them to try to get that to take care of them before everything was just, everything was taken away from them. And so that's when the Bureau of Indian Affairs was formed, and they started watching out for these guys. But these cattlemen, they came in and they had their ranches, and they had their, they had their ambition, and they wanted to see things happen. They wanted to build their own businesses, and they got afraid of the Indians. And the railroad wanted to expand all over the country, and they had their ambitions. And both the cattlemen and the Indians actually wanted to see the railroad expand, but like I said before, they wanted a piece of it. And so just having to figure out how to keep everybody happy was a big deal. And by 1883, it wasn't, forget the Indians. We don't care about them. Maybe that attitude existed with when we were first coming across the plains and annexing all these territories. But after a while, it got to the point where we're gonna have to live with these people and deal with them somehow. So, like people like Arthur, that in my book, and then historically, I saw that there were a lot of advocates for their rights, and they did get rights, and they were able to develop herds, and they were able to get, free shipping on the railroad and stuff like that. But it took some people standing up and fighting for it, and not just the Indians, but the settlers, the white men. Some of them saw the error of their ways and said, we need to support these people, do something about it. So it still exists today. There's still I grew up in Sheridan in the 60s and the 70s, and there's still a tension between, the quote unquote settlers or descendants of the settlers and the tribes that live on the lands. And it's gotten better, believe it or not, it has, because they've gotten a lot of stuff thrown their way. One of the things is all these gambling houses and stuff they're allowed to build, and the billions of dollars that now come through their tribes. I mean, they're sitting pretty pretty on those things. So it's a complex issue. There's no cookie cutter thing about it, and it wasn't even cookie cutter back then. It was very
No.
complex. So, it was
Yeah,
the
I
people
think
that wanted
everything.
to. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think like everything in life, there's no like, there's so much gray. And I think the book really illustrates that there's so many different facets to these things when they're being experienced, right?
Yeah, I mean, historically, it was a big deal to see the railroad expansion all over the country. It really connected the country. You got to the, you went from, it would take, 3 months to get from, Kansas to the West Coast in a wagon. Maybe even if weather and stuff could take up to 6 months. And then with the railroad, you could be there in a week. Now today we can be there in a couple hours. But with that, when that railroad came in, it just connected the whole country. It made the country smaller in a way. And it was it changed our culture, very much so. My grandfather, who I dedicated the book to, he was a railroad conductor for 40 years, and he conducted a train on that very line from Sheridan to Billings, Montana, and back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And I think he retired like about 1966 or something, but he was there that whole time. And so I got a lot of information from, he passed away long time ago, but I got a lot of information from my aunts and uncles about him, and about, different things that that he told them about that railroad line, and the relationships the railroad still has with the Crow Nation that's still there. So that was a lot of that was very
That's
informative.
incredible. There's so much that goes into the storytelling. I love how you're illustrating this so well. I'm seeing all these lines and bubbles and different story arcs in different areas and how they all come together. It's magical. At the center of this story is really love, risk, and rescue. So what do you think people will feel most deeply when they experience this book?
Well, I've always had the philosophy that no good action adventure thriller or anything else is worth its salt unless it has a nice love story in it. Because you got to give them some, you got to give your protagonists on both sides, the man, the woman, you got to give them something to fight for. And there's
Temptation.
nothing, there's nothing better to fight for than the one you love. And so, the resonance in the book is, he rescues her, but she also rescues him in a deeply personal way because she gets him over the trauma that happened to him during the Civil War, something that nobody else has been able to do in his life. And so the bond that, generates from that is just I took a long time trying to develop that. In fact, last year when I was writing this book, I actually took a class about writing from Oxford University studying classical literature, and I told my professor I was really interested in developing my romantic writing a little bit. So we did, and I think it helped a lot. I think it really helped a lot. In fact, I think that's one of the biggest reasons that I got signed on with Headline Books with Kathy Teets, and she saw my writing after that class, and she actually really liked the romance in the book a lot. So that really helped me, move forward with the publishing and stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. Congratulations. I want to talk more about the horse. I find animals so fascinating, and I feel like there's so much about powerful presence in Swiftwind. So, what does Swiftwind represent on a deeper level?
Well, Swiftwind is kind of like connection, connects Island to her crow heritage in the book, because Swiftwind is like a legend in the Crow Nation. Everybody knows who the horse, the stallion of a pony is. Everybody, and especially in the Crow Nation, is a little bit fearful of that horse because you don't touch him, you don't mess with him, and you darn sure don't mess with Eileen or a pony. There's one scene in the book where when he was only like a 2-year-old and a pony was training him when Eileen was only about 16, 15 years old, and she was standing out there watching her mother train Swiftwind, and a rattlesnake was creeping up on Eileen, and Eileen didn't notice it, but Swiftwind did. And Swiftwind broke away from her, Eileen's mother, and ran over there and stomped that snake to death before it could get to Island and hurt her or possibly kill her. And her mother told her, she said that they both have a special spiritual connection with this horse, and that that horse will always be there for both of them. And so I use that scene there to play up on how Swiftwind plays an integral part in breaking away from the people who captured the ranchers that captured Eileen and her mother a pony and threatened to kill them if the Chief Pretty Eagle didn't sign the deal with the railroad the way they wanted it to go through. He broke away and he runs for like hundreds of miles to find Arthur. And in front of Chief Pretty Eagle and all the other people there, he walks up and he chooses Arthur. Arthur's never met this horse before. He doesn't, he, you know, they've never been connected, but the horse somehow recognizes him, goes up and he rubs his head on his chest and stuff like that. And just, he chooses him. He lets him, you can ride me. And so Arthur hops up on Swiftwind to everybody's like astonishment. The horse doesn't buck him off and try to kill him. And I put some stuff in there because Arthur is not a skilled rider. He's always been a little hesitant of horses. He was raised in the Caribbean. He's a sailor. And so there wasn't a lot of chance for him to really develop his equestrian skills. So he's always been a
Well, it
little
was
hesitant
all
of horses.
instinct and loyalty and that intuition, which makes that so powerful.
Yeah. So the connection between them is really strong. And, by the time it's all said and done, they're both racing in. He's on top of, and oh, and Swiftwind doesn't allow anybody to use a saddle. Everybody's got to ride him bareback. So the girls ride him bareback, and Arthur, who's not a skilled rider, and see, I worked for a dude ranch back in college, so I did trail rides, so I have a little bit of training in horseback riding and stuff, and so I understand, what it takes to stay on a horse galloping bareback. It's not an easy thing to do. And but Arthur has to figure it out, and actually, I show in the book how Swiftwind kind of teaches him. As they're heading towards rescuing the girls, Swiftwind's teaching Arthur how to ride. But by the end, he charges in, gets the bad guy, and Swiftwind helps him.
It's funny, as we're speaking about this, I can hear the sound of a galloping horse in my mind right now. It sounds so powerful. So, Dan, the title Legacy Son is powerful. So I'm just curious what legacy means to you, and why do you think it's something that more people should be thinking about today?
Well, legacy in the book is that obviously his mother and his father were the most successful abolitionists in the Caribbean at the time. And he had some trauma during the Civil War where he was trying to protect some slave children. And it really wasn't his fault, but they were killed. And he couldn't rescue them. In fact, Marshall Lloyd had to drag him away from him getting killed too, trying to do something about it. But it was just a terrible situation, and it really affected him badly because the way he grew up, his mom and dad, they gave their whole lives to, protecting and freeing the slaves. And so that's why he joined the war effort. So that really affected him, pretty badly. So the legacy part is that he doesn't feel like he lived up to that his parents' legacy. In the even though he was just hugely successful, I show in the book where he helped this Pinkerton man bring some plans to General Grant that helped him win the war and free the slaves. But all Arthur can see is those kids dying. And the beginning of the book, there's the first, very first lines in the book is that scene. What happened with those kids, and how it's a nightmare that he is continually having as he's getting older. And so, he throughout the what happens in the Railroad Man is him coming to terms with it, coming to terms with his feelings, and rising above it to the point where he does feel by the end of the book that he's lived up to his parents' legacy.
Amazing. So your background is so eclectic. It includes ministry, business, martial arts. How do you feel like those experiences have shaped the way you tell stories?
Well, I love to write fight scenes, and I get a lot of compliments on my fight scenes. There was something when I was studying martial arts, especially under a man named Bill Shaw, who's a Hollywood stuntman, fight choreographer, stuff like that. He's been in several movies with Billy Zabka and Sylvester Stallone and some other people, and he's designed a lot of different fight scenes. But we used to have this thing called one steps, and one steps is attack and response, and we had to write them down and memorize them for just one attack and a response, or several responses to that attack. And the way our we call them Sifus in Chinese-based martial arts, we call them Sifus, the master instructors. Like in Japanese-based martial arts, they're called sensei, same thing. But my Sifu, he would that's how he would explain the fight move, one move at a time. Throw a right cross, block with an inside outside block, counter with a strike or a chop, something like that, just simple stuff. But he would do it one step at a time, and we'd have to slow it down in our minds and then figure out how to put it in fast motion. Well, when I started writing, I thought, man, this would be a great way to explain fight scenes, because you get because you're teaching kids how to memorize these movements, and new students, white belts, why not just put it right in the book through the fight scene? And I've gotten so many compliments about my fight scenes because that's how I explain them, one move at a time. And The protagonist does this, and the antagonist does that, and they end up on the ground, and they roll, and I show the blocks and the punches and the effects and all that, and so it's in the kicks, and so having a martial art background gives me a plethora of moves and things that I can put into the writing, and I think people really enjoy that. There's a great fight scene at the end of the book between Arthur and the big bad guy, and it lasts about 3 pages, and everybody loves it so far. So I'm not going to give it away or anything, but it's a good fight scene, and I think you feel like you're in it, right in the middle of it. So that martial arts, that's one of the ways that it's helped me write. And then having my own business, having employees, being responsible to customers, making contracts, da da da. That's invaluable. Like even with Railroad Man, I made Arthur a very successful executive in the Burlington Northern Railroad, and he was responsible directly to the president, Mr. Dillon, and how he handled himself in business situations is, the way I gleaned from my own personal life and handling business and doing contracts and talking to employees and talking to managers and all that kind of stuff. And so it's all in there, and it just helps you. I mean, any kind of experience that anybody can gain in life, if they want to write, they can put it into that writing. I mean, it's nice. The more experience you get, the more full of a life you live, the more you can, the more you can tell stories, the more you can formulate, great, drama of any type, if you want. Being a minister, bringing the whole religious side of life into that goes without saying. I mean, there's just so much. Like I grew up as I'm no longer a practicing Catholic. I belong to a different set of ministries and stuff, but I grew up as a Roman Catholic, and so I understand that culture very well, especially from my hometown. And so as more of a comedy relief than anything else, I put this wily, funny, very endearing Monsignor Catholic priest right in the middle of the book. And he which has, it's just the way he's introduced and all that, and what he accomplishes for Eileen especially is just pretty cool. So that was cool to be able to do that, and understanding how they, he's going up to Sheridan to be the new Monsignor, which is a guy that will take over the whole church, and how everybody would treat him and the respect that everybody had to show for him, even the bad guy and this really rich guy's son who's kind of arrogant. This priest, once he showed up, they all had to keep their mouths shut and listen to him. So I used him as a kind of a buffer in a couple of situations, so that was fun. And yeah, so anything that you can, like, a person can glean from life, whatever their background is, you can use it in a story. Sure. I mean, I think that's everybody
It
does
makes it come to life, right? Because it's you're drawing from authentic stories that you've actually lived. And your own knowledge of that. It's so important, so fascinating. So tell us where we can find this beautiful masterpiece.
Well, it's on Amazon. In fact, today's the 19th, so it is officially released in 5 days. So, March 24th, it'll be released in physical copy, which is this guy right here. It's less than 300 pages, and it's a pretty quick read. I mean, most people can read it in a couple of days. And it'll be released digitally, April 1st. So we're just getting right in before it's released.
Beautiful, beautiful. So, what do you want people to experience when they read this book, or what do you want people to get from it?
Want them to have an appreciation of how the West was built and the different intricacies that go into it. I mean, people are pretty familiar with the sheriff and with the cow drives and all that kind of stuff. But they're not so familiar with the whole thing between the railroad, the cattlemen, and the tribes on the reservations. And that was a complex issue that had to be worked out, and it had to be worked out where everybody was happy. Otherwise, you just would have had a lot more bloodshed. and stuff. So, and they did eventually work it out, but it was a tough time. It was a tough time because it was after, it was after the Indian Wars. It was after all that stuff where, the settlers came in and took over the land. Now we got to figure out how to live here, whether right or wrong. We got to figure out how to live here. You're not gonna, you're not, all these people that just moved there are not gonna pick up and leave because somebody else thinks they're wrong for doing it. I mean, it's just, it's a done deal. So how do we make, how do we get this mess to work? And that's what they were doing in 1883. They were figuring it out. They just, so really to take an appreciation of the history of our country, the United States, and what happened in the West, to make things work. It's not perfect. Never was perfect, but this is how they wanted the, this book shows how a portion of that conflict was worked out.
Beautiful. And Dan, do you have anything that is coming up for you? Do you have a sneak peek on anything to come? Are there any more books in the works?
Sure. Right now I'm working on a book that is, the title I'm messing with is Cornelius, the First Gentile Christian, and he was it's the backstory of the man in Acts chapter 10 in the Bible, Cornelius, who Peter went to his house, the Apostle Peter went to his house, had a meeting with his friends and family, and got him saved with his friends and family. And he's the first re person recorded in the Bible that was a Gentile. That means a non-Judean that joined the Christian church. And he's always fascinated me. He was a Roman centurion, so that means he was a very accomplished Roman soldier. Centurions were people who, they've been in the Roman army for probably 20, 30 years. They got promoted to the top of their what was available to them to be promoted in. I kind of equate it to like a sergeant major in, in our military, it's the top rank that a non-commissioned officer can reach. But it's not like a lieutenant or a captain or something like that. It's a whole different level of officers. But these centurions, they were like the highest ranking non-commissioned officers in the Roman army, and they basically run the whole show for, the legionnaires and all that, and then the officers, the legates, and the people who were over the whole army really relied on these guys. So this, he was a pretty incredible guy. And in biblical research, you'll see there's about 22, 23 people that are mentioned as centurions in the New Testament for the Roman army. And I think all of them have been mentioned positively. So they just have some, there was a lot there. So I'm still working at it. I'm about, 15,000 words into it and about 200 pages worth of notes and all that stuff. And so I'm just working out the backstory and, trying to figure out, who he was and where he came from and where he grew up. And I think I got a pretty good idea just from what, from secular sources and plus biblical research. And I think it's going to be a pretty exciting book. It'll go along the same lines as my book, Magi Apprentice, which was the backstory of the wise men who visited the baby Jesus in Matthew chapter 2.
Wow, amazing. I love it. There's so many exciting things coming up for you. Thank you so much for being here and congratulations on the Railroad Man Legacy Son, which is going to be released in the next few days, which is super cool. Do you have any last minute thoughts you want to leave the audience with today?
I think that reading stories really expands our minds and our hearts to understanding life. I know that down through the years as I've grown older, I really respect all the different stories and all the different authors I've read, and I highly encourage people just to keep reading, and read stories, read fiction. And enjoy yourself while you're doing it because it can expand your mind. It can take you to places maybe you didn't know existed inside yourself. And it might explain some things about you and about the world you live in from another person's point of view, from an entertainment level, which is kind of neat, So that's why I like to write. I like to tell stories. I like people to have stories that resonate with them, that they remember, and that they can equate to different parts of their own life.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, Dan. It was so much fun talking to you.
Well, thank you for letting me be here, Lisa. It's been wonderful.
It has been. And I think the question that I'm asking myself, and maybe the audience can ask themselves, is what kind of legacy are you building right now? We'll make sure to have the links for the books in the show notes for you to have easy access to Dan's work. And stay tuned for the next episode. Take care, everyone.
Kellybrook is Betway's casino ambassador, and for all new customers, stake £20 and get 150 free spins. Download the Betway Casino app today. 18 plus T's and C's apply. Bet the responsible way. Gambleaware.org.